From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made the first week of August, 2023. Here's how my colleague at WXXI, Brian Sharp, reported what was happening in Rochester at the time. Quote, after months of speculation that Rochester could be a destination for displaced migrants, two buses from New York City carrying 77 people seeking asylum in the United States arrived at the Holiday Inn on State Street. They were greeted by local officials and social service workers who presented them with food and clothing and introduced them to their accommodations, including showing them how to use key cards to enter hotel rooms and how to use microwave ovens. People who met the migrants said they traveled light. Of the 77, more than half are children and teens, records show, with an average age of 7. One pregnant woman was among the group, officials said, end quote. Again, that's more than a year ago, and today more than 470 people have come to Monroe County seeking asylum, having crossed the southern border without documentation. There are families, individuals, many children. In recent weeks, Republican candidates for state office have been on this program saying that these individuals should be immediately deported because they do not have documentation. Republicans have said that the asylum system has essentially become a sham, that everyone claims asylum, that most people don't get it, and that the state should end all resources going to support asylum seekers. Ibero-American Action League has taken a different view. These migrants are desperate, Ibero says. Many are eager to work as soon as possible, to contribute, to support themselves. This hour, it's a chance to get an update on what is happening in our community. My guests include Angelica Perez Delgado, President and CEO at Ibero-American Action League. Welcome back to the program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to Lucia Calindres Vazquez, Chief Program Officer at Ibero. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And welcome back to Daisy Ruiz, Director of Migrant Services at Ibero-American Action League. Daisy, welcome back to you.
Thank you so much.
And I want to mention here, you can understand why this is a difficult time for migrants in our community. We had hoped to talk to one of the people who have been served by Ibero and is now living in this community, but they were unable to be here. I just want to let you know that we try not to have conversations about groups of people, categories of people, without them represented, but I also understand things happen and something came up today. So we are proceeding with the conversation. And let me just take a step back and I'll go around the table and ask our guests for a little bit of an overview on what's going on. I think what would be useful for our listeners is to understand, let's start with numbers and then we're going to talk about how support happens for people who need it, how people go through. I mean, I talk about it like a program, like they're graduates. I suppose that's the right way to describe it. So we'll talk about what that means. We'll talk about how they're doing, the housing situation, work permits, how many are able to work, whether they are getting help making asylum claims, how long asylum claims take. So there's a lot to work through here. Let's start with numbers. And I'll start with Angelica, but I'll turn to the panel for all of these questions. Do we know how many people are in our community now, having come up through essentially this crisis?
Yes. So through the Migrant Relocation Assistance Program, which is the program that Ibero operates, we have relocated 471 individuals, which is a total of 120 families.
Okay. When they arrive, they receive support in what way? Can you all take us through that process?
Yeah. So families come to us in different ways. One of the ways you mentioned, which was through the arrival of the buses at the hotel. And we also have received families that have come directly from New York City into their apartments that never spent time in the hotel. The program is really intended to place individuals who have employment authorization documents and asylum receipts in public housing who are going to work their way to self-sufficiency within the period that they are in the program.
How long does the program last?
It could be up to 12 months. But families can graduate whenever they become self-sufficient and are able to pay for their own basic needs.
471 individuals, 120 families. How many graduates, for lack of a better term?
Right now, I believe we are at 35 individuals who have graduated, with a handful of them graduating before the 12 months.
Okay. And I think the last time I talked to Daisy Ruiz, we talked about work permits and a system that sometimes made people wait quite a long time. 7 months? I'm not the expert here, Daisy. You want to remind people the situation when individuals arrive in these circumstances in our community, when they are allowed to work and what's going on with that?
So I know the last time I talked a little bit about the asylum process. And normally during the asylum process, after they have submitted an application, it takes about 6 months in order for them to be eligible for a work permit. Now there's certain situations where asylum applications are being denied, clocks are being stopped, and that is causing for individuals not to be able to receive that permit at the 6 months. Now, another option as well was a TPS application that came out during that time for anyone that arrived from Venezuela before July 31st, and that process has been a little bit smoother where families are receiving their work permits earlier.
Okay. Is this system working, for lack of a better term, Daisy?
It definitely needs to be fixed. The system definitely needs to be fixed in order for these families to start working sooner. My fear is that now that we are at the 12 months, we have seen families that have been in the program for over 12 months. We are seeing families that still do not have their work permits. And unfortunately, they are unable to reach self-sufficiency during those 12 months due to the clocks being stopped or due to the system not working in their favor.
So how long should there be a lag in allowing work permits? What do you think?
I definitely think that it should be within the 30 days. Mm-hmm. These families want to start working. They do not want to depend of a program. They do not want to depend of, you know, the government. They really are wanting to work.
You agree with that, Angelica?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we saw some of that play out with the refugee status individuals that came from Ukraine. They were very quickly integrated into the community, were able to receive their work permits within 30 days. We think a similar framework for our asylum-seeking families would be one of the greatest solutions because they are eager to work. They mobilize fairly quickly. And the delay in the work permits really becomes the greatest challenge.
When it comes to getting those work permits or the rules changed with this, this is a state or a federal issue?
Right now it's federal. Immigration issue is the federal
okay,
issue.
Okay. So the rules that we're describing are the rules for work permits in Texas, in New York, in Maine. Okay. And you're hoping for a federal change to that.
Yes.
Is there any momentum that you're aware of to make that change?
Well, we had some momentum a while back when the bill was trying to be passed, and it wasn't. You know, it was a bipartisan bill that would have offered some relief. But
is this the same bill that keeps getting brought up in this
yes.
president? The Lankford, the bipartisan bill?
Yes.
Co-drafted by a pretty conservative Republican senator from Oklahoma, James Lankford?
Yes.
And that would have changed the work permitting requirements?
I think it recognizes the ability of processing people at the border. Another issue that we have with our asylum seekers that people don't realize is it is not illegal to seek asylum. When you come into the border and you turn yourself in and you say, I'm seeking asylum, that is your right, a human right that's given to anybody who's seeking asylum from a country. And when you're not processed in an appropriate manner, it delays that for you. So let's take one of our families, for example. They cross the border. They turn themselves in. They say they're seeking asylum. They're placed in a 5-day, 3-day hold, separated from their families in Texas. Then they're put on a bus, sent to New York City, where they're then put into some kind of hold placement until people can figure out what to do. Then they were put on a bus for a 10-hour ride to Rochester. And 2-3 weeks have gone by and no one has processed their asylum application. And it isn't until they come in contact with us, and maybe even a couple of weeks later, right, because we're trying to meet the basic needs of this family, that somebody actually sits down and help them fill out their asylum paperwork.
And then that starts the clock of 6 months.
Yes.
So what the Lankford bill, the bipartisan bill, would do is allow that processing to start literally at the border, not weeks or months later.
It put the resources at the border to be able to process everyone as they come across.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So before, one more question on work, and this is an ignorant question, but I do think it's worth asking as we see more families, again, 471 individuals, 120 families who have crossed the border, who are now living in our community, pursuing asylum. It is not the same situation. They're here legally under the law. But it is not the same situation. Their status is not the same as, for example, what we see in Springfield, Ohio, which got all the attention this summer. It's a different situation. What I'm curious about with work is this. Despite all the noise and frankly, some of the bigotry that we saw in, about Springfield. What we also saw was employers in Springfield and in Western Ohio, including a number of Republican CEOs, come out and say that we've been able to restaff. We've been able to scale up because of a workforce that is very eager to work, very dedicated, very diligent. Mm-hmm. As our numbers are growing here, we don't have 5,000, 10,000 people. It's still in the low hundreds and a lot are children. But are we seeing, is it possible that we would see, as they pursue work opportunities, the chance to support local employment and employers with that same kind of sentiment? And I'm not trying to fish or lead here. I'm actually curious about this, Angelica. Yeah.
We're seeing a lot of that already. I mean, we've been really efficient at placing a lot of our asylum-seeking adults into employment because there is a need, there's a demand. A lot of them are low starting wage jobs, but there are jobs that have not been filled. I mean, we have over 20 that have been employed at places like Rochester Regional Health. We work very closely with several transportation companies that need driver helpers. We have local automotive companies or car dealerships who have had a difficult time hiring for mechanics or detailing that have hired a lot of our families. There's definitely a connection there to be able to accelerate, which decreases their dependence on any state, support or aid or, you know, whatever people think they're taking from our communities. And what we found with our families, they actually move a lot faster than we do. So while we were trying to figure out how to get them employed, a nice chunk of them figured that out all on their own.
Can I ask all three of you, are there stories that are not necessarily success stories? Are there people who have struggled, other people who have mm-hmm. seen that clock run out? And I mean, what should we know about that?
Yeah, and I think Daisy may have a few examples of people who have not been successful because of other challenges. So I'll let Daisy share.
I actually have a family. It's a single mother and her child. She was one of the families that were bused over back in September to our local hotel. And she has been in the program for 12 months. Now, due to her being bused over from New York City, randomly, she lost her court dates, which her initial asylum application was denied due to that. Now she had to reapply. When they're going to the courts, they're also being told that if they want to have representation from an attorney, most of them, they're going to say yes. And that pushes out their court hearing, and that also stops their clock. So now I have a single mother who is currently pregnant, 8 months pregnant, with a child, finishing the program, that has not been able to reach self-sufficiency due to not receiving her work permit for over that year. And now, one of her options would be to return back to New York City, right, into a shelter due to not being able to stay in Monroe County.
Okay. Yeah. So that's an example of someone who is struggling for various reasons here. Yeah. Are the majority of individuals and families finding a lot of success? You're all nodding, yes.
Yeah, about 62% of our adults are working. Most of our families are two-parent family homes, so they've been able to work through some of the childcare challenges that all of us face in our community. But that's something that we have seen them very quickly jump into the workforce and work towards their self-sufficiency. And what folks don't remember is when you're applying for asylum, that's one of the criteria, right? So nobody wants to stand in front of a judge and say, I'm dependent on public benefits, I'm dependent on all of these things. Part of the asylum process is to pledge that you will not be a drain on government resources. So they're all fully aware that their best way to seek an asylum and to being here established individuals is to actually be self-sufficient. So every day they're working and thriving towards that. But I think going back to a point that you made, Evan, is I think that's just a bigger issue in our society. We see that with farm workers, right? We want them to work for us. We want them to grow our food, but we don't necessarily want them to be citizens. And I think that's some of the dynamic that we're seeing now. We're seeing a lot of same people who may publicly support some of this rhetoric be the same people that are the deepest invested in the workforce development of our asylum-seeking families.
What happens after 12 months for the individuals, they've had support for 12 months, and then what?
So they graduate out of the program. Yeah. It's a maximum of 12 months that they receive in assistance. And my team provides case management services to make sure that they are working towards self-sufficiency. We have had over 20 families graduate out of the program already. And that's not just families that have completed their full 12 months, but I have families that are thriving and they are graduating the program at about 6-7 months.
Okay.
I was just going to mention that this program, although offers a great opportunity to individuals, right, it is heavily regulated. So there are a lot of rules that we follow and that we have to manage, right, those resources very effectively. So it comes with a lot of work, and it comes with also a lot of monitoring. So it's not easy to be part of those programs. So therefore, it really pushes individuals to seek self-sufficiency and utilize the resources that they have allocated for a very short period of time, right, to kind of get them going. But it is also done by referral. So it's not like anyone can just, you know, they have to be pre-screened, they have to be selected to be part in the program, and then monitored throughout that time. So that comes with, sometimes it's complicated because there are situations that are outside of their control and outside of our control because those programs are so heavily monitored.
So after the 12 months... They are essentially on their own? Is that
they
the right
are.
Way to, yeah?
Yep, okay. They are. The program is designed to help them with three basic things. We pay for their rent or subsidize a portion of their rent as long as they need it. We give a very small amount for food because a lot of them are not eligible for public benefits like food stamps. And then we provide some basic items for their house, which are usually donated. One of the things that I looked into when I first got into this program, when my bureau first volunteered to lead this program, was in comparison to public benefits, these people are getting less than that. So these families are navigating with, likely less than $25,000 a year if we were to look at it. So they're definitely very quickly thrown into a position where they have to become self-sufficient because, they're not getting, the food stamp allocation or some of the other benefits that our citizens would get.
They're all seeking asylum. How many... How long is the average asylum claim taking to be adjudicated?
Years.
Do we know?
Years.
So out of 471 people in Monroe County, have any of their asylum claims been fully adjudicated? None.
No. None.
None. And that's, correct me if I'm wrong, Angelica, you brought up the bipartisan, for lack of a term, the border bill that people have been hearing about that addresses a lot of things, not just Border Patrol agents, but a lot of different aspects of this. My understanding is that part of what they are pursuing is more resources to speed up
yes.
the process of asylum claims.
Yes,
and
it is.
And right now it's still very slow.
It is very slow, and it's slow for our new asylum seekers. It's slow for the people who have been in this country for a while, who are seeking their own paths to citizenship. I have a staff who came here from the Dominican Republic, who has been here for over 3 years and just literally got his residency. And it came at a, he has a job where he can afford, a lawyer and be able to move himself ahead of the line. But even when people say, I don't know what the right path or the wrong path is, but, in societal terms, like the people who follow the rule, even those people are having a hard time getting their cases processed.
So perhaps we'll see, depending on what happens at the federal level, perhaps we'll see a change in resources to speed up the asylum process.
Yeah.
The data that I have, federal data indicates that asylum denial rates grew to a peak of 71% denied in 2020, 63% denied in 2021, 37% granted. So that's the latest data I have. About a third of asylum seekers go to courts unrepresented at all.
Yeah.
You've got a much better chance at gaining asylum, being granted asylum, if you do have legal representation and you're not unrepresented. but it's somewhere in the 30 to 35% mm-hmm. range so far that I've seen in recent years of claims that are upheld, that people get asylum. Around two-thirds are denied.
Yes.
That's correct?
It is, and it drastically changes per state. So when you, I don't, and I'm thinking you're quoting national data.
National data.
When you break that down and begin to look at certain states, those denials rate severely drop to sometimes less than 5% in some states.
What about New York? Do we know?
I don't know off of the top of my head. I know New York is one of the highest, but even in New York, it wasn't, 90%, 100%. I want to say it might have, don't quote me, but I think it was right around some of the same numbers that you were quoting, like less than 50%, and that's part of when you think about a family crossing the border. We had a situation, actually, me and Lucia, I was in Puerto Rico when this happened. We got a call from our local DHS office that the sheriffs had picked up a family with a child at the airport who was wandering. I got a call in Puerto Rico and they said, Angie, we have found this family. We really don't know what to do. We can't place them because of their legal status. So in the middle of the night, I'm calling Lucia and saying, connect with DHS and let's figure this out. What we found out about that family is they crossed the border. They turned themselves in for asylum. They were separated for a day. And then someone walked in and said to them, we want to put you in a lottery to come to New York. And they said, wow, a lottery to come to New York. We will play for all your airfare. They won the lottery, which I'm assuming a lot of people did. They were put in a plane to New York that ended up not going to New York City, going to Rochester. They literally thought they can walk to New York City when Lucia arrived to meet with them. I think those are some of the sad realities. We found a family with a two-year-old living under a bridge that had a similar scenario. They had been placed in an airplane and told that they won the lottery to go to New York City. And ended up in Rochester. There's this belief that sometimes at the border, they're told if you go to New York and if you go to California, your asylum case will be approved. You will have a perfect life. And this is how a lot of these families are getting on these buses and going to New York City.
If they are denied asylum, then is that where deportation happens?
There's like an appeal process that occurs and,
it's not same day.
Yeah, it's not same country, day.
But that would start a process of them being, okay. Now, when it comes to what you're describing, a 12-month program, a chance to kind of gain a foothold, create self-sufficiency, housing, et cetera. New York State allocated $2.4 billion for migrant services in the recent fiscal year. And I'm wondering if that is the bulk of what is, do you know what the breakdown is of taxpayer support for this is mm-hmm. federal, state, local, et cetera?
The way that the Migrant Relocation Assistance Program is funded is through executive order from Governor Hochul. She allocated $25 million out of the executive budget. And that $25 million was divided into five counties in upstate, where the counties were either deemed sanctuary cities or the county itself raised their hand and said, we want folks relocated here. We lead two out of those five counties. We do relocations, not just in Monroe County. We also do them in Albany. And then I believe the other county is Westchester, Suffolk, and Erie County.
Recently, Ibarra hosted a forum that included a number of local leaders, state leaders, the deputy county executive from Albany County. Mm-hmm. What did you learn from that, Angelica?
What I've learned from this whole process is how complicated immigration is and how nearly impossible it is to achieve the American dream that we idolize in our home countries. I found myself having a lot of conversations with families as I watch them reconcile some of the disheartening, right, of coming to, you walk three continents to come to a country to find out that you're not really welcomed or wanted here can be pretty devastating to families. I love their energy. They believe if I work hard, if I just work hard, you know, I can get there. And we tell them, yes, work hard and keep working to get there. But we also know the challenges that they face will make that. They will have to work harder, a lot harder than most people to achieve the things that they need to achieve. So I think that has been my greatest lesson. My goal has been through this whole situation is to humanize the stories. Imagine walking with your family, leaving because they were massacred by government. Imagine burying your two-year-old in the jungle of, you know, Costa Rica because they got a fever and you were in the jungle and they died right there. I've watched children say, I remember you from the river. And then you get the rhetoric, right, that comes after that. And these are humble people that don't even want to be here. They want to be in their country. But unfortunately, their country is unstable. And they took on this journey. And we're really proud that we were able to answer the call, despite the rhetoric, despite the hate mail that we get and the phone calls that we get. We're really proud that we were able to welcome them in the same way that we welcomed Hurricane Maria families after Hurricane Maria. So we're really proud of that. But I think that's been my greatest lesson, is just how we dehumanize people so quickly with the rhetoric.
I see this hitting you pretty hard emotionally.
Sorry.
Why do you think it's affecting you this way?
Because they're my people. You know, they're my aunts, they're my uncles, they're my cousins. When we received the first bus, I remember picking up a baby who had the same diaper for 12 hours. I remember walking in with Lucia into the bus and convincing them that we were there to help them. And them saying to us, where are we? Are we in another state? And us laughing and saying, no, you're in upstate. Unfortunately, it takes 8 hours via charter to get here. And the fear in their eyes. And I think what touched me the most was the children and their resiliency. And so many kids. So as people go on this rhetoric, all I can see in my mind is little 7-year-olds and little 10-year-olds and little babies and people who have worked really hard. And, you know, one of the stories that I shared about a mom burying her 2-year-old, that's a real story. She showed us pictures of her baby because that's all she has.
Can you all describe for listeners what the housing situation has been like? A lot of talk about the circumstances and where that stands now.
Yeah, I'll let it's been difficult. So I know there's a huge undertone that we experience in both counties that somehow our folks are taking housing away from people. What I will say before Daisy kind of talks about the experience from our program is that we also had a lot of landlords burnt out from the pandemic that really want an agency in between to help mediate some of the concerns that they have with tenants and also be able to mediate the relationship. So although it was really difficult for us initially to find apartments, I know some of the negative media that the MRAP program received was that the contracts were executed in June, yet we didn't move any families in until middle of September. And a lot of that was tied to our inability to secure housing as fast as it was needed. But for the most part, we've had a group of landlords that has wrapped around our program that we've been collaborating with and Daisy has worked closely with.
Do you want to add to that, Daisy?
Yeah, pretty much what Angelica said at the beginning when we started this program, it was very difficult for landlords to trust the program. It took about, I want to say, September when OTD actually released a landlord fact sheet with more information, educating landlords about the program and kind of just giving them that security that the families would be helped during those 12 months. So right now we have over 100 apartments here in Monroe County. that we're using for the NRAP program. And these landlords did have that fear from the pandemic. They had the fear of having to evict the families. So my housing team has worked very hard to just continue a good relationship with our landlords. Angelica has a communication as well with them. So just having an agency that can be that middle person pretty much has helped our program tremendously. And they, every time, these landlords that are currently in our program, they call us every time that they have an apartment available because they've had such a good experience with the tenants. The tenants are clean. They have their money pretty much secured during the time of the program as well.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to a team from Ibero-American Action League. You just heard Daisy Ruiz, Director of Migrant Services, Angelica Perez Delgado, the President and CEO, Lucia Colindres Vazquez, Chief Program Officer. And this is an organization that is at the center of the work in making sure that people who have crossed the southern border seeking asylum and end up in our community, that they have resources when they arrive here to try to become self-sufficient. So they enter a 12-month program. It's a program of getting support, as you just heard, housing, among other things. After 12 months, they are essentially on their own. Many have to wait 6 months for to even get a work permit, and many will tell you they want to work right away. They're desperate to work. We've heard that this hour that 62% of adults who've come to our region through this program are working. And right now the number is 471 individuals, 120 families have ended up in Monroe County. Monroe County.
Yeah, yes. Total across the state is over 1,000.
Yeah, over 1,000 across the state. So that's what we're looking at here. How are they doing? What is the resource allocation? Is it working? What's the status of asylum? What we're hearing from our guests today is that they are seeking asylum. It can take years. Nobody out of 471 individuals, again, many kids, but a lot of families, many adults, hundreds of adults, no one has had their asylum claim fully adjudicated yet in this last year plus of people coming here. So it's a program, it's a process that really has to be sped up. Folks at the federal level say this. There are bipartisan bills aimed at doing that. They haven't passed. It's an election year. We'll see what happens. I do want to listen to a part of a conversation I recently had on this program. And this is not intended to try to bring any sort of back and forth partisanship. I mean, our guests here are not here representing any political party. They're representing work in our community. What we have been hearing in this election season is that, number one, there are, I would say it's pretty fair to say that it's almost uniform that Republican candidates for state office, they want to zero out all state allocations for this kind of programming. So $2.4 billion from New York State, they want to bring it to zero. They say that in many ways, they don't believe that we're using the right terminology, and they deny the legal status of asylum seekers who the courts have told us are here making legal claims. Now, those claims have to be adjudicated, but they are not here illegally if they're seeking asylum. Well, candidates for office have said that they want to change that. This is a part of the conversation we had recently with a candidate for New York State Senate, a Republican, Luis Martinez. Let's listen.
To become an asylum seeker, here's the thing. We're talking about right now, the question you're asking me is about the, say, 12 million, pick a number, 10 million, 12 million of illegal aliens that have invaded our border under the current administration. But there's at least 12 million more that the State Department is holding back who want to immigrate here. They filed the papers. They paid the money. They hired the attorneys. They have suffered for years trying to come to the United States legally, and they're being ignored.
But to be fair, I'm actually not asking about that. Okay. I'm asking about New York State. You're running for state senate, yes, allocating $2.4 billion to help asylum seekers who have come to some come to Rochester, some are in Buffalo, many are in New York City. And this is an allocation of money to make sure that there is short-term housing, a little bit of resources. Mm-hmm. And there's a conversation in Albany as well about work rules, about whether there can be expedited work rules, because a lot of these folks simply do want to work. So I'm asking, first of all, would you have voted for that $2.4 billion if you're in the state senate? You would not.
Correct.
Okay. But why are you using the term illegal alien for asylum seekers?
Because that is a correct term for people who crossed the border without papers. Then after they came here, then they are being given papers by the current administration, which should not be happening, because these are not asylum seekers. These are there is no plan whatsoever to seal the border. If they would, they could. If they could, they would. But they have no plan to do that. So then, when they come across illegally, let me shift it around. I have been to Mexico countless times. One of my clients was a major company that everybody would recognize, and I installed a payroll system in Mexico for that company in Spanish. I crossed the border into Mexico every morning, and I came home every evening. And that was my deal. My point is that I had to show papers every morning in Mexico to prove to them that I belong there. Every morning, they saw me yesterday, they saw me last week, they saw me last month, and every morning I followed their rules for their, you know, I respected their rules. Our rules are not being respected at all by millions of people.
That is Luis Martinez. He's running for New York State Senate. Let me ask our guests if they want to weigh in on what they heard there. There's a lot there. I'll start with Angelica Perez Delgado, President and CEO at Ibero-American Action League.
I would invite Luis Martinez to give me a call to come and learn about the great work that Ibero is doing with these families, to meet the people in which he's referring to. You know, I know that there's a lot of opinions out there, and I think it's a misconception of not being close to the work. So I think it's easy to say we want to deny access. But once you meet those people, I would challenge that a little bit. So my invitation would be Luis Martinez. You know, there's time. You know, if you want to show face, you know, Ibero, 124 Evergreen Street, we work with, like you said, we're a bipartisan organization. We work with anyone who has the best interest of Latinos in mind. And I would welcome him to join us in learning more, help. He can educate us and we can educate him.
Has he been there?
No.
Okay. Lucia, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yes, please. well, a couple of things that I heard during the comments. Invaded. He used the term
said they've invaded our border.
Yeah.
Asylum seekers. Yes.
He used the term illegal, which I know it's a term to degrade or put down, right? An entire group, which is often used anytime that, you know, different groups want to kind of gather attention. And the thing about this, he also, I believe he mentioned about people who are following the correct process and they're still not, you know, here. So I'm from El Salvador, born and raised over there, came here with a green card. And my family has a history of, you know, having crossed the border and different things like that. And that is primarily because we were poor. So when you're following that process that he's talking about, it's only for those who have privilege to pay or own property. So if you are from those countries and you're applying, you're most likely going to get denied. So that's just, you know, one of those things. But also, for me, it's challenging, you know, for me, speaking for Lucia Colindres, when I hear other Latinos who's have, we know, you know, how Latinos immigrated here, especially, you know, from Puerto Rico, they're U.S. citizens versus other Latinos, right? So when they come to this country, perhaps their parents came with an asylum, you know, or however, it's hard because they're already here, right? So they're past that, other generations that basically took advantage of how their relatives made it here. So that's hard for me to grasp. Around that feeling of we made it, but others don't deserve that opportunity.
I think, I don't want to speak for the candidate, I think what he would say is people should have that opportunity and they should do it the way that my family did it.
Yeah, and that's why I welcome him to come and join us in a conversation. I you know, we are open at Ibero with our work, and I think it's critical to have all of our government elected be educated in the people that they represent. And Ibero serves a very large constituency. We serve over 32,000 Latinos across upstate New York, many of which are legal residents. Those are the voices that we uplift. And for me, the answer is come and see the work. I really think it's hard to maintain that stance when you're close to the work. So I invite, you know, Luis Martinez, I don't know you, but hey, I invite you to show up. Like I said, 124 Evergreen, we can walk those streets together. We can visit a couple of migrant families. We can have some coffee at El Camino Cafe on the International Plaza, and then we can talk it out. Because power and representation is important, and it breaks my heart that we can represent a lot of different interests without never once talking to them. So, and I have beautiful, you know, I don't even have to take you to the asylum seekers. I can take you to the beautiful staff. I had a challenge securing finance staff, and I have an accountant who was an economist in Venezuela, who is right now an accounts receivable specialist in our finance department. I have a Dominican CPA level that when he came to Ibero was cleaning asbestos and is now a senior accountant, you know, making a decent living and taking care of his family. I have countless stories of people who migrated here in many different ways, some of which maybe Luis may portray are wrong ways, but they are contributing in deep ways to our community and our economy. So for me, it's about the humanizing component. I won't engage in the rhetoric because I know the people. I get to work with them, you know, every day. And this is, you know, a touchy subject considering what we've been through this week as Puerto Ricans. But, you know, my island is my island. I know what they try for. I spend, you know, good time in Puerto Rico. My sisters live there. My cousins, my nieces and nephews. So I know the quality and the caliber of people in which we serve and all of the things that they aspire to be. And I offer the opportunity to Luis or any political candidate to show up at Ibero's door and let us show them that.
Daisy, do you want to add anything there?
No, I just want to repeat the same thing, pretty much same message that Angelica and Lucia have mentioned. Half of my staff have migrated here. And they are, you know, doing this work every day. I also want to invite him to just take a look at our annual luncheon, right? We have a wonderful story for one of the MRAP participants that would provide you a little bit more of insight of why they decided to move here to Rochester, why they're going through the whole asylum process. It was a little sad that Daisy wasn't able to participate today with us, but her story is just wonderful. She graduated the program six months early, but she came here. She, you know, was persecuted in Colombia. So these are real stories.
Yeah, I would say, as the interviewer listening back, what I would like to talk to Luis Martinez about is that I understand the idea that he wants everyone to have paperwork and documentation. Mm-hmm. And I get that. Mm-hmm. Number one, the bipartisan bill at the federal level that the Republican mm-hmm. Party put a hold on mm-hmm. would have at least sped up processing at the border, created more paperwork at the border, created a better system that both sides of this, including the Border Patrol agency, approves of. So it was Luis Martinez's party that stopped that from happening earlier this year. Who knows where that goes next? But beyond that, to seek asylum is to seek to leave persecution behind, sometimes mm-hmm. political violence. And of course you're not showing up with documentation. It's the very definition of it. Someone who is persecuted, attacked by their own government or attacked by criminals or gangs, you know, you're not leaving the house in the middle of the night going, well, hold on a second here. Let me get that documentation of the United States in the bottom drawer that I have, and then we'll make a nice tidy exit here. Of course you don't have documentation. So what Luis Martinez seems to be saying is that there's no such thing as an asylum seeker. Hmm. Now, he can point to the data, which shows that roughly 2/3 of asylum seekers are denied, and say that he thinks most of it's baloney. That's his right if that's what he thinks. But that's still a third of claims mm-hmm. upheld, which is thousands and thousands of people who have been found through an adjudicated process to be eligible for asylum based on extraordinary circumstances. And they did not show up with paperwork. They did not leave in the middle of the night and stop by their local clerk's office and get that paperwork. Mm-hmm. That's the definition of seeking safety in a crisis. You're not going to have paperwork when the house is burning down. But that is a conversation for a separate day. Before we go, a couple of things here. You did mention it's been a hard week, you said, for Puerto Ricans. I think you're referring to the comments made at Madison Square Garden by Tony Hinchcliffe, who was a comedian who was speaking in front of the MAGA rally, who essentially referred to Puerto Rico as a floating island of garbage. And, you know, today you've got J.D. Vance and others saying, I'm done with this idea that no one can take a joke, et cetera. It wasn't a Puerto Rican saying that. It was a white comedian who I don't think's probably ever been to Puerto Rico. But can you just describe a little bit about how that hits you?
Well, I was definitely very emotional. I think, you know, hearing others verbalize how they experience your homeland, American soil. I mean, we're not even talking asylum seekers. We're talking about born Americans. Is very disheartening, but not surprising.
Do you think he knew that Puerto Ricans are Americans?
Probably not. But this is what I mean.
This is
the point that I make. It is easy to dehumanize people that you don't know anything about. And I think, you know, as Puerto Ricans, we're very proud people. So there's obviously been a lot of discussions among the Puerto Rican community in the last couple of days. But I'm not surprised. I mean, we saw this play out over and over again after, you know, during Hurricane Maria. There's no surprise that we're perceived by a group of Americans as people who are not worthy of even citizenship, if they even know that we're citizens. But I know that my island is very resilient, and we will overcome these things. But it was very emotional, because it's not just about Puerto Ricans. It's the bigger rhetoric and the bigger narrative around Latinos. So it's just another piece of the puzzle. So he also mentioned eating cats, you know. So it's when you put all of those things together, the narrative that is expressed about one of the largest minority groups in the country, the group of people who are the future of America. We will be the majority in America, and we will shape the landscape of America. So an investment on the Latino community is an investment in America, is an investment in the United States. But we're seeing that structural component of racism really play out in front of our eyes. And it was very, very disappointing. Not disappointing because it was expected. It just hurts. It hurts to hear that and to think that in 2024, it is okay to say things like that out loud.
Jillian writes to ask, can your guests discuss what help from the community they need besides money? So good place to start to wrap this conversation. If people who are listening want to help in some way with these 471 individuals, 120 families, a number that will undoubtedly continue to grow, anything you want them to know?
Yeah, we work closely with Rochester Hope. As many of you guys know, Ibero is located at the St. Michael's campus on North Clinton. So Rochester Hope has taken the initiative of furnishing a lot of the apartments and providing a lot of the clothing and some of the basic needs. So we continue to encourage people who have furniture, who have basic household items that they want to donate, or clothing, to take them there. Unfortunately, Ibero does not have the infrastructure to accept donations in that way, but that's one of the partners that we've been using. So that's a great way to help people right away in their deepest moments of need.
And Daisy, looking ahead as the director of Migrant Services, I want to ask you this, and again, this is a conversation that is not meant as a partisan one, but let me just ask you. So I'll just ask you, it's not about politics, it's about reality of policy. There's a lot of talk on the Republican ticket, which could very well win, of mass deportations. Could we see these 471 individuals deported under certain circumstances, depending on who wins?
Not at this time. They're still going through the asylum application.
So
they have to go through
even
the
with
process.
The claims of that ticket. Those individuals would still have the right to stay here and finish out their asylum claims.
Correct. They are currently here legally. I think we still are fighting that that misconception during the process they're here.
Well, the reason I ask is because, you know, we talked about Springfield. the thousands of Haitians in Springfield are there legally as well. Mm-hmm. And this goes back not just this administration, but the previous. Mm-hmm. And yet Donald Trump is talking about deporting all of them. All of the Haitians in Springfield who are there legally. So I don't know that he has the power to do it, but I no longer know that he doesn't. I don't feel like I know at all what power he will hold if he is elected, because he has essentially said that he can do what he wants. And he said at the rally this week that the Supreme Court's given him immunity to do what he wants. So I ask, that's why I ask about deportation. But it's your understanding, at least for now, those individuals would stay and go through the asylum process no matter who wins.
Correct.
Okay. I want to thank you all for taking the time to come here. 30 seconds, Angelica. What do you expect to happen next, just in terms of migrants and what is happening in this community?
Yep. We'll continue to relocate families slowly from New York City here. We'll continue to work with our landlords and continue to help families become self-sufficiency. The program will not go anywhere. We're on contract until 2027, and we expect that this pilot will continue to be as a program beyond that.
Thank you for making the time. That is Angelica Perez Delgado, the president and CEO at Ibero-American Action League. Lucia Calindres Vazquez, chief program officer at Ibero-American Action League. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Daisy Ruiz, director of migrant services at Ibero-American Action League. Thank you, Daisy.
Thank you again.
A lot of information this hour. Appreciate all their time. We got more connections coming up in just a moment.